takeaways from the far right surge in European Parliament. We will talk about an advocacy group that finds a fifth of Latino voters are leaning towards third party candidates. And we'll give you the latest on Samuel Alito and his wife. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Let's make a little money on the bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. You'll get instant access. I'll see you then, and we'll be back tomorrow with a new show. Welcome, everybody. Hope you had a good weekend. One of the nice things we got going into the weekend was another very strong jobs report. And when you see job creation exceed expectations, and when you see a sustained low unemployment rate, if you're rooting for the country, if you're rooting for workers, if you're rooting for small businesses and the people, you would be happy about such news. You would say, oh, I'm on the side of my country and the people who work here. And therefore, when job creation is strong, when unemployment is low, it's something to be happy about. I know this would be sort of like a weird introduction to a story if there were not a group of people actively rooting for the country's demise, or when they can no longer do that because it's so obvious the economy looks pretty good, they start taking credit for it despite the fact that they are not in power. And this is much of what we see from the modern Republican Party, and particularly from the MAGA right, which is desperate to either destroy Biden's economy, pretend it's no good, or say it's only good because of the expectation that Donald Trump is ultimately going to become president. And that's why people are hiring. Can you imagine what, I mean, listen, I'm a business owner. What on earth would lead me to hire someone today? Because I think that 7 months from now, Trump might be inaugurated. Even if I believed that Trump being inaugurated would do something to the economy that would then help my business in some way, and I would need more people, why would I be hiring people now because of that? It just doesn't make any sense. And so here's a few examples. Here is Fox News and others. They either laugh about the reports, or they seem almost like they're announcing the death of someone. Let's look at a couple of examples of this.
This is something. 272,000.
Nancy Lazar was right. She was right.
She was right.
272,000. Everybody, the estimate was 185,000. And by the way, that blows even the top of the range from economists going in. The range was 120 to 258, and we came in at 272.
And as you can see there, Maria Bartiromo sort of amused, like, maybe I believe these numbers, but certainly not something she's particularly thrilled with. Here's another one from Fox News. They sound almost like funeral announcements.
All this considering the much larger than expected May jobs report we got this morning. You know, all the Ivy League trained economists out there predicted a gain of 185,000 non-farm payrolls during the month. Instead, the economy added 272,000.
Not any mention of the fact that this is continued year over year strong economy, the likes of which presidents usually get rewarded with re-election when they oversee. Now, for comparison, here's like a more normal reaction for CNBC from CNBC to good numbers for workers in your country.
Right. We should all be happy that we've got a strong economy. You know, I know you were just mentioning there's two schools of thought. Is it the strong economy school, or we have to have lower interest rates for the market to go higher? I'll always take a strong economy.
Right.
You know, at the end of the day, it's all about the economy. It's all about GDP growth, GDP, corporate earnings, the health of the consumer. That's going to win out all of the time in the long run. So the health of the economy is more important. If you look at where the jobs are being created, we're in the same big categories. Where the government came back to be a big hire again. Healthcare, and our favorite, travel and leisure. You know, businesses are renormalizing. We see it all the time. But people are traveling for business. It's no longer just personal travel.
It's what it is. And even Newsmax had to admit, damn, this actually does seem pretty good.
Well, it's important to take a big picture view here. And if you zoom out to what the economy looked like just prior to the pandemic, you'll see that about 81% of Americans aged 25 to 54, that is prime age Americans, were working. Basically no change today. Today, also around 81% of prime age workers working. And so this one...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Okay. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are profoundly shocked at the impact on civilians of the Israeli forces operation in Al-Nusrat at the weekend to secure the release of four hostages. Hundreds of Palestinians, many of them civilians, were reportedly killed and injured.
A pair of new UN reports has accused Israel, as well as Hamas, of committing war crimes in Gaza. This comes as pressures growing on both sides to back the ceasefire and hostage deal endorsed by the UN Security Council. We'll get the latest. Then a jury in Delaware has convicted President Biden's son Hunter of all three felonies in a federal gun trial for buying a gun at a time when he was using illegal drugs.
No one in this country is above the law. Everyone must be accountable for their actions, even this defendant.
And in a historic verdict, a federal jury in Florida has ordered Chiquita to pay over $38 million in damages to the families of eight Colombian men killed by paramilitary death squads funded by the banana giant. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad have submitted a formal response to a United Nations ceasefire proposal for the Gaza Strip. A Hamas spokesperson said the group's priority is to bring a complete stop to Israel's assault on Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has yet to respond publicly to the U.S.-backed ceasefire resolution, which was approved by the U.N. General Assembly Monday. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Tuesday Netanyahu had, quote, reaffirmed his commitment to the proposal, unquote. This comes as Israel continues its unrelenting assault on the Gaza Strip. Among the latest attacks was an airstrike on a home in Gaza City's Zeitoun neighborhood earlier today that killed at least six people. In Jordan, world leaders and top aid officials gathered Tuesday for an emergency humanitarian summit on Gaza. They were joined by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Excellencies, the horror must stop. It's high time for a ceasefire, along with the unconditional release of hostages. I welcome the peace initiative recently outlined by President Biden and urge all parties to seize this opportunity and come to an agreement.
A new report by a UN independent human rights body finds both Israel and Palestinian armed groups have committed war crimes since Hamas's surprise attack on October 7th. The damning UN report accuses Israel of using starvation as a method of warfare, forcible transfer, and intentionally directing attacks against civilians. It calls on Israeli leaders to immediately end attacks, resulting in the killing and maiming of civilians in Gaza. End the siege, implement a ceasefire, and to pay reparations. The report also calls for the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages held by Hamas. On Tuesday, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin congratulated Israel's military chief over Saturday's raid on Nusayrat refugee camp, which freed four Israeli hostages. His call to Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant came as the United Nations top human rights office said Israel likely committed war crimes during the operation, which killed at least 274 Palestinians. 64 children were among the dead. Nearly 700 others were wounded. Jeremy Lawrence, spokesperson for the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, said Israel's actions had left human rights workers deeply shocked.
Hundreds of Palestinians, many of them civilians, were reportedly killed and injured. The manner in which the raid was conducted in such a densely populated area seriously calls into question whether the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution, as set out under the laws of war, were respected by the Israeli forces.
Israel's military says it killed a senior commander of Hezbollah during an assault on southern Lebanon Tuesday. Talib Abdallah is among the most senior Hezbollah officials killed since cross-border fighting between Israel and Hezbollah escalated 8 months ago. Meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed six Palestinians during a military raid on the town of Kfar Dan. Among those killed was the brother of a 12-year-old child who was killed by Israeli forces in Jenin 2 years ago. In Washington, D.C., peace activists with Code Pink disrupted a public address Tuesday by National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. He was speaking at the American Jewish Committee's Global Forum in Washington, D.C.
Jake, thank you for being here with us today. We know...
Jake Sullivan, you are a war criminal. 15,000 people, 15,000 kids dead is not self-defense. Jake Sullivan...
Code Pink activists Olivia DiNucci and Medea Benjamin were quickly removed from the venue. Their protests came a day after officers with the Federal Protective Service fired a salvo of pepper ball rounds to clear demonstrators who'd erected a tent encampment outside a San Francisco federal building to protest U.S. support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Elsewhere yesterday, President Joe Biden was interrupted by a protester who accused him of being complicit in genocide.
The main reason I'm here is to say, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart.
No.
President Biden was speaking at a Washington, D.C. conference hosted by Everytown for Gun Safety. As the protester was led away, the crowd chanted, four more years.
Folks, it's okay. Look, they care. Innocent children have been lost. They make a full point.
The protest during President Biden's remarks on gun violence came just hours after a jury in Wilmington, Delaware, found his son, Hunter Biden, guilty of three felony charges for illegally purchasing a gun at a time when he was using drugs. Hunter Biden becomes the first child of a sitting U.S. president to be found guilty of a crime. Special Counsel David Weiss spoke after the verdict.
This case was about the illegal choices defendant made while in the throes of addiction— his choice to lie on a government form when he bought a gun, and the choice to then possess that gun. It was these choices and the combination of guns and drugs that made his conduct dangerous. Second, no one in this country is above the law. Everyone must be accountable for their actions, even this defendant.
A date for a sentencing hearing has not been set. Hunter Biden faces up to 25 years in prison, though a strict sentence is unlikely, and Biden could avoid jail entirely. In the Gulf of Aden, at least 49 people have drowned and 140 others are missing after a boat carrying African asylum seekers sank off the coast of Yemen. At least six children are among the dead. The refugees had been fleeing violence, poverty, and the impacts of climate change in the Horn of Africa. The UN's International Organization for Migration reports nearly 100,000 asylum seekers arrived in Yemen last year, many of them bound for Saudi Arabia and other wealthier nations. That's more than triple the number who made the perilous crossing just 2 years prior. Malawi's vice president and nine members of his entourage have been confirmed dead after their plane crashed in a mountainous region of the southern African nation. Saulos Chilima had served as Malawi's vice president since 2020, was expected to challenge incumbent president Lazarus Chakwera in elections scheduled for next year. The Biden administration's lifted a ban on arms shipments to the Ukrainian military unit known as the Azov Brigade, a former militia with ties to far-right hate groups. The State Department said Tuesday a thorough review turned up no evidence the brigade's members have committed human rights abuses. The Azov Brigade was founded in 2014 by a self-avowed neo-Nazi and white supremacist. Meanwhile, delegates from 90 nations are set to gather in Switzerland this weekend for a Ukraine peace summit, though Russia and key nations, including China, will not be participating. Swiss President Viola Amherd on Monday outlined the summit's goals.
We want to discuss ways for a comprehensive, just, and lasting peace in Ukraine based on international law and the UN Charter. We want to develop a common understanding for a possible framework to reach this goal. And we want to decide on a schedule together, how both parties can be tied into a future peace process.
The pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson has agreed to pay $700 million to settle lawsuits brought by more than 40 state attorneys general over its asbestos-laced talcum powder, which has been linked to cancer. As part of the settlement, J&J will permanently end the production, sale and marketing of all products containing talcum powder. In 2018, a Reuters investigation found the pharmaceutical giant knew as early as 1971 that some of its talcum powder contained dangerous levels of asbestos, but covered up its findings about the deadly carcinogen. And a federal judge in Tallahassee has struck down Florida's ban on gender-affirming care for minors, ruling the law unconstitutional. U.S. District Judge Robert Hinkle also struck down a provision that erects barriers to adults seeking transition care. In a 105-page order handed down Tuesday, the judge writes, quote, "In time, discrimination against transgender individuals will diminish, just as racism and misogyny have diminished." To paraphrase a civil rights advocate from an earlier time, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice, he wrote. The legislation was signed by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis last year. DeSantis has promised to appeal the ruling. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
An independent United Nations panel has concluded Israel and Hamas have committed war crimes since October 7th. In a new report, the UN Commission of Inquiry outlined a number of war crimes committed by Israel, including using starvation as a method of warfare and intentionally directing attacks against civilians. Part of the report details how Israel has also committed crimes against humanity for its, quote, widespread or systematic attack directed against the civilian population in Gaza. The report goes on to accuse Israel of committing numerous crimes against humanity, including, quote, extermination, murder, gender persecution, targeting Palestinian men and boys, forcible transfer, and torture, unquote. The UN Commission accused Hamas of also committing numerous war crimes, including intentionally directing attacks against civilians, as well as torture and, quote, indiscriminately firing projectiles towards populated areas in Israel, unquote. The UN accused both sides of committing sexual violence. The United Nations' top human rights office also accused Israel of committing war crimes on Saturday, when Israeli forces killed at least 274 Palestinians in the Nusairat refugee camp during an operation to free four Israeli hostages. This is Jeremy Lawrence, spokesperson for the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights.
We are profoundly shocked at the impact on civilians of the Israeli forces operation in Nusairat at the weekend to secure the release of four hostages. Hundreds of Palestinians, many of them civilians, were reportedly killed and injured. The manner in which the raid was conducted in such a densely populated area seriously calls into question whether the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution, as set out under the laws of war, were respected by the Israeli forces.
The UN's top human rights office also accused Palestinian armed groups of committing war crimes for holding hostages in densely populated areas. This comes as Israel and Hamas are being urged to accept the three-phase ceasefire and hostage deal outlined by President Biden, endorsed by the UN Security Council. On Tuesday, Hamas submitted its response to mediators from Qatar. The U.S. claims Israel's already agreed to the plan, but numerous Israeli officials have publicly attacked the deal. Israel is continuing to bombard Gaza, where the official death toll is 37,100. But that's believed to be an undercount, since thousands of bodies remain under the rubble. We're joined right now by Sarah Lee Whitson, executive director of Dawn, a group working to reform U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Sarah, welcome back to Democracy Now! Sarah Lee, start off by responding to this ceasefire deal and where you think it stands. This is the one proposed by President Biden almost 2 weeks ago, the first time the U.S. didn't veto a ceasefire deal at the U.N. Security Council, but actually sponsored it.
It's a welcome proposal, if only 8 months and 40,000 dead Palestinians too late. Absolutely nothing of value has been achieved in this 8 months of carnage in Gaza. The Biden administration is basically trying to pressure Israel into accepting a ceasefire proposal by pretending it's an Israeli ceasefire proposal. While Hamas has accepted this, Israel has not yet accepted this ceasefire proposal, and in fact has communicated its unwillingness to abide by a ceasefire by continuing its heinous military incursions into Gaza.
And the specific issue of whether Israel supported it or not, we've heard Secretary of State Blinken repeatedly say that they were just waiting for Hamas to respond. What do you sense is the situation here between the U.S. government and Israel on the ceasefire?
I think that the United States is trying to has been trying to push Israel to halt its operations, begged Israel for several months not to make an incursion into Rafah, all of which Israel has repeatedly ignored. I don't know whether the attack on the Nuseirat refugee camp that was part of a so-called rescue operation is something that the United States offered up its acquiescence and participation in exchange for Israel agreeing to a ceasefire. I imagine that the timing of this raid, certainly after the ceasefire proposal had been made, raises questions about that. But what we repeatedly hear from Israeli officials, not American officials purporting to speak on their behalf, is that they will not accept a ceasefire proposal until they achieve their mission of destroying all of Hamas.
And in relationship to this weekend raid, your perspective on reports that the United States provided intelligence and logistics support to the operation?
Well, it has been widely reported and confirmed by a number of U.S. government sources that the United States has been involved in the planning of this raid for several months, and specifically provided intelligence as well as logistical support for this operation, which of course resulted in the murder of over 270 Palestinians. Entirely predictable when you randomly drop bombs all over a refugee camp that many, many people will die. Not only is it a grotesque, indiscriminate attack on civilians, Israelis deployed perfidy to carry it out. They dressed themselves up as civilians in a broad daylight attack. They used an aid truck that was videotaped approaching the area, as well as a civilian vehicle pretending to be refugees fleeing with a mattress on their car in order to trick Hamas forces and to allow the operation to go forward. There's also been a report by Hamas, which has not been verified, that the operation also resulted in Israel killing three other hostages, including a U.S. citizen, but we've not yet been able to confirm that.
I wanted to go to a clip of Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, He was on CNN, and he was being questioned by Dana Bash about what took place in Nusrat. He was being questioned while in Paris.
The United States has been providing support to Israel for several months in its efforts to help identify the locations of hostages in Gaza and to support efforts to try to secure their rescue or recovery. I'm not going to get into the specific operational or intelligence-related matters associated with that because we need to protect those. I can only just say that we have generally provided support to the IDF so that we can try to get all of the hostages home, including the American hostages who are still being held.
So I understand that intelligence, U.S. intelligence assisted, but will you say anything about U.S. personnel, U.S. weapons?
Well, the one thing I can say is that there were no U.S. forces, no U.S. boots on the ground involved in this operation. We did not participate militarily in this operation.
So if you can talk about that distinction that he's making, and then go on, Sarah Lee Whitson, to respond to these two UN reports.
Well, as I'm sure Jake Sullivan actually knows, military participation is not defined by boots on the ground, and his rebutting or refuting that there were American boots on the ground and therefore America was not militarily participating in the attack is absolutely false and wrong under international law. During the Yemen war, for example, and this is why Mr. Sullivan should know this, U.S. Lawyers advised the White House that American intelligence and logistical support for the Saudi war in Yemen would make the United States and makes the United States a party to that war. Similarly, American logistical and intelligence support for an active military operation means that the United States has actively participated in the conflict and is a party to the war. Why this is particularly bad, bad policymaking, is that not only does it make the United States liable and complicit for prosecution for war crimes, including the war crimes that took place in the attack on the refugee camp, but also opens up U.S. forces to reprisal attacks and counterattacks as a party to the conflict, as a legitimate military target. If the Biden administration has not sought a war powers resolution to enter the United States into such active participation in military operations, that is obviously a violation of our own Constitution and yet another example of the Biden administration entangling us in military conflicts in the Middle East without congressional approval and ratification. With respect to the UN reports that have just been issued, they conclude what everybody else who is an expert in law and has observed, which is that the number one, the attack on Nusrat refugee camp was itself a war crime, and it involved deliberate targeting of civilians as well as indiscriminate targeting of civilians. Sadly, this is just piling up on top of ceaseless, relentless war crimes and crimes against humanity that have been underway in Gaza for the past 8 months. And that is the conclusion that the Commission of Inquiry's report released today reveals. We now have mountains of UN reports, UN experts, the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, shouting from the rafters that Israel is carrying out war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. And yet, all of this is showing us, sadly, that Israel has no interest in international law, and the United States has no interest in demanding that Israel actually comply with international law, besides rhetorical flourishes added in statements to the press in the United States. The continued military support to Israel is really not just a savage attack on the Palestinian people. It is a savage attack on international law itself, and it will come to haunt and hurt America for decades to come.
And I wanted to ask you, Sarah Lee Whitson, in a related issue in terms of the attacks on Gaza. On May 15th, your organization, Dawn, sent the State Department a dossier documenting how a group has been attempting to disrupt and prevent aid reaching the people of Palestine, the Palestinians in Gaza. Could you talk about that group and others that support it?
That's right. The Israeli group, I don't want to mangle the pronunciation, Sapi 9, is a organized group of settlers in the West Bank that have deliberately and repeatedly attacked humanitarian aid convoys headed to Gaza. This has been an organized effort coordinated on WhatsApp and other social media to announce exactly when and where the attacks would take place. We are urging the Biden administration to sanction this group, but not only to sanction this group, but to sanction the Israeli companies and NGOs, nonprofit organizations that have been actively fundraising to pay for these attacks on humanitarian aid convoys. I mean, it just boggles the mind that we have vigilante groups who are deliberately attacking food and medicine trucks meant for civilians. I think it raises a tremendous concern and question about the psychology of Israelis who would do such a thing. But more significantly, we want the Biden administration to exercise its sanctions that it has announced for violence in the West Bank, not only against these individuals, not only against this group. They are not just rogue lone wolf operators. They are supported by an infrastructure and network of companies and businesses and nonprofit organizations that are funding their efforts. It's particularly appalling that an American NGO has been involved as well in a fundraising for these really disgusting attacks on humanitarian aid convoys. And we think that the IRS should closely examine whether these contributions violate their rules under the IRS as charitable donations.
We spoke to an Israeli human rights lawyer who tried to interrupt the settlers who were trying to stop the aid convoys. That group, Tzav 9, Tzav in Hebrew means command. Sarah Lee Whitson, we want to thank you so much for being with us, executive director of Dawn, an organization working to reform U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Next up, we turn to the conviction of President Biden's son, Hunter Biden, on all three felonies and that gun trial for buying a gun at a time when he was using illegal drugs. Stay with us. Plume by Tashi Wada, featuring Julia Holter. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A federal jury in Delaware has convicted Hunter Biden of all three felony charges for illegally purchasing a gun at a time when he was using drugs. Hunter Biden becomes the first child of a sitting U.S. president to be found guilty of a crime. Special Counsel David Weiss spoke after the verdict.
Ultimately, this case was not just about addiction, a disease that haunts families across the United States, including Hunter Biden's family. This case was about the illegal choices defendant made while in the throes of addiction, his choice to lie on a government form when he bought a gun, and the choice to then possess that gun. It was these choices and the combination of guns and drugs that made his conduct dangerous. Second, no one in this country is above the law. Everyone must be accountable for their actions, even this defendant. However, Hunter Biden should be no more accountable than any other citizen convicted of this same conduct. The prosecution has been and will continue to be committed to this principle.
Hunter Biden faces up to 25 years in prison, though that strictest sentence is highly unlikely, and Biden could avoid jail entirely. A date for the sentencing has not yet been sent, President Biden's vowed not to pardon his son. In a statement on Tuesday, President Biden said, "As I also said last week, I'll accept the outcome of this case and will continue to respect the judicial process as Hunter considers an appeal. Jill and I will always be there for Hunter and the rest of our family with our love and support. Nothing will ever change that," he said. We're joined now by Ben Schrechinger, a reporter for Politico. He's the author of The Bidens, Inside the First Family's 50-Year Rise to Power. Ben, if you could start off by responding to the verdict in this trial, what exactly it means, what Hunter Biden was charged with and convicted of.
My first response is that it's just not that surprising. This was a fairly straightforward case. Most criminal trials result in convictions. This wasn't an exception. It is noteworthy, in part for the reasons that the special prosecutor mentioned, showing that no person is above the law. You know, Hunter Biden was held accountable for his actions here. Politically, this may actually be marginally helpful to President Joe Biden. The dominant images Americans are seeing out of this trial and its aftermath are of a loving father who's supporting his son. A lot of people have been sympathetic to that aspect of Joe Biden's relationship with his son. And it's you know, holds less political peril than investigations related to Hunter Biden's personal finances or business dealings.
Yeah, and Ben, I wanted to ask you about that, the difference and potential impact between this this conviction and the trial that will be coming up in Los Angeles, the potential for that trial to be much more dangerous to President Biden himself and to other aides of the president.
Yeah, well, that trial is about Hunter Biden's taxes. And as prosecutors have outlined, it will get into his foreign business dealings. The tax years he's being charged for are not during his father's time in office, but the sources of income, some of those trace back, like the money from Burisma. Those were engagements that did begin during his father's time in office. That may present a less relatable, less flattering picture of the way Hunter Biden was making his money, although it doesn't really deal with some of the things that that investigation originated with, where prosecutors were originally looking at potential Foreign Agent Registration Act violations, potential money laundering violations. Those have not been charged and may never be charged. And those, you know, were avenues of inquiry that had to do more with President Biden as political power than even Hunter Biden's taxes do.
I wanted to go back for a minute and ask you about this case. You have Hunter Biden, who is accused of lying on federal firearms application, which is a crime that is not usually indicted alone, like you could be, you know, they convicted him of lying, saying that he was not using drugs at the time that he was going for a gun. But it usually happens, the indictment, if then you use the gun. Can you talk about the significance of this and that David Weiss, the special prosecutor, was appointed by Trump and President Biden decided not to get in the way of that, though he could have let him go, is that right, before this indictment?
Yes, that's right. This was a trial that in some ways was never supposed to happen. David Weiss, I read, was not even present in the courtroom when the verdict was read out yesterday. David Weiss was, you know, originally charged with investigating Hunter Biden's finances. This gun offense came up sort of tangentially in relationship to that investigation and was supposed to be dealt with as like a, you know, a probationary diversion kind of agreement when Hunter Biden was going to enter into a plea deal. That plea deal fell apart. Arguments have been made that it fell apart because of political pressure being brought by Republicans in Congress. I don't know if there's any way we'll ever know for sure if that's the case. So this was not really what the investigation into Hunter Biden was ever about. Once that plea deal fell apart, David Weiss decided to bring the charge. And yeah, you're absolutely right. President Biden could have sacked David Weiss, as he did the other U.S. attorneys who were serving under Donald Trump. He kept him on. Merrick Garland appointed him as special prosecutor. Obviously, there would have been a lot of political scrutiny and uproar from Republicans if Weiss had been replaced. So here we are.
Also, President Biden has said he will not pardon his son. Many in the media have commented on the difference between how Donald Trump conducted himself during his trial and how the Biden family and Democrats have responded to this case. The media cite a very different tone. What's your response to that?
Yeah, there's a pretty sharp contrast in how Joe Biden has publicly responded to this trial of his son and how Donald Trump has responded to his several criminal indictments. Obviously, Donald Trump has lashed out at the judge, at prosecutors, sought to portray the cases brought against him as part of a political witch hunt. President Biden has said that he'll respect the legal process here. As you said, he's vowed that he will not pardon his son for this crime. So that's, quite a contrast and two very different approaches by two presidential candidates to the legal system here.
Speaking of the election, you have in September the tax trial in Los Angeles against Hunter Biden. And then you have the October sentencing in this as a result of this conviction. This is all right before the November election. Before we go, Ben, you wrote the book on the Bidens. In fact, it's called that, The Bidens Inside the First Family's 50-Year Rise to Power. If you can talk about some of Hunter Biden's private communications revealed about his business deals and what's going to come out right before the election?
Yeah. A lot of what I've learned in recent months has come out of the Republican-led impeachment inquiry in the House of Representatives. One of the more striking communications that's come out there is one from the period when Joe Biden was out of office. Hunter Biden's pursuing deals with a Chinese energy firm, which are relevant to his upcoming tax case. And he says something to the effect of, you haven't paid me this money that I believe you owe me. If this doesn't come soon, my father and I are going to come after you with everything we have. Money does start to flow a few days after that. Joe Biden has said, I wasn't actually with Hunter, despite what's in that message. That's not true. Hunter Biden has said, I was in no state of mind to be speaking coherently. He's attributed essentially to his drug addiction, that message. But obviously, those sorts of communications have the potential to be more politically damaging than evidence presented at this trial that was really more about Hunter Biden's personal life.
Well, Ben Schreckinger, we want to thank you very much for being with us, reporter for Politico, author of The Bidens Inside the First Family's 50-Year Rise to Power. We'll also link to your articles on the Bidens and particularly on Hunter Biden. When we come back, a federal jury in Florida has ordered the banana giant Chiquita to pay over $38 million in damages to the families of eight Colombian men killed by paramilitary death squads Chiquita funded. Stay with us.
All the companies keep a sharp eye, pay their respects to the army, watch for the hot-blooded leaders, and be prepared for the hunter. Trust them like flies. so heavy the price that they pay, as deadly the fruit it has stolen, over the blue Caribbean, the leathern shadow of...
Phil Oakes, United Fruit, covered by Vic Sata. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with a landmark ruling in a case that sought to hold a major U.S. corporation liable for its links to human rights abuses in another country. On Monday in Florida, a federal jury ordered Chiquita Brands International to pay over $38 million in damages to the families of eight Colombian men who were killed by paramilitaries that Chiquita funded. The banana giant previously pleaded guilty to paying the far-right United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia paramilitary group, known as the AUC, $1.7 million from 2001 to 2004, which Chiquita argued it did to protect its workers. The AUC has been found responsible for committing mass human rights abuses and murdering civilians from 1997 to 2006. Federal prosecutors argued Chiquita's support for the AUC was, quote, prolonged, steady, and substantial. This is Raquel Sena, widow of one of the killed farm workers, responding to the jury's decision.
I'm never going to overcome his death. We want Chiquita Brands to acknowledge us because they're the ones who paid for people to get killed here.
Meanwhile, Colombian President Gustavo Petro responded to the ruling with a post on X asking, quote, why could U.S. justice determine in judicial truth that Chiquita Brands financed paramilitarism in Urabá? Why couldn't Colombian justice? Chiquita is one of the world's largest banana producers and says it plans to appeal the jury's verdict. For more, we're joined by Marco Simons, general counsel for Earth Rights International, part of the legal team that represented plaintiffs in this case against Chiquita. He's joining us from Washington, D.C., where he's just returned from Florida. Welcome to Democracy Now! Marco, if you can start off by talking about exactly what the jury ruled, who these families were, and the larger political picture of Chiquita. Ultimately, it's not only about Chiquita in Colombia, Chiquita, which earlier was United Fruits, but throughout Latin America and Central America in particular.
Yeah, thank you for that. So the jury in this case ruled that Chiquita was responsible for financing the AUC paramilitary death squads over a period of at least 7 years, found that Chiquita was unreasonable in the legal sense of that in doing so, and that this funding contributed to the deaths of the plaintiff's family members at issue here. And importantly, the jury also specifically rejected Chiquita's defense that they had put up, which was that they were extorted and under duress, that essentially they were making these payments in order to save lives. The jury ruled that Chiquita did not meet any of the requirements for the duress defense. They found that Chiquita was not under an imminent threat, that Chiquita essentially voluntarily put itself in a position where they would have to make these payments, and that they found that Chiquita had other options other than to make these payments. So even if you believe that, Chiquita's argument that, they were essentially forced to make these payments, they were not—that's not a legal excuse for their responsibility here. Now, we don't believe that that was the case. We believe the evidence that was put in front of the jury showed that Chiquita essentially had a partnership with the paramilitaries, that they voluntarily paid these groups in order to protect Chiquita against left-wing guerrillas and essentially to pacify the operating environment in the banana-growing region of Colombia. Now, it's important to note that these eight deaths represent only the start of Chiquita's potential liability for its conduct, not the end of it. These deaths represent less than 1% of the claims for killings that have been filed against Chiquita in U.S. courts. There are thousands of claims that have been filed. And so if you do the math from the verdict here, Chiquita's potential exposure in potential future trials for more victims is well into the billions of dollars. So we think this is a tremendous victory. We're incredibly gratified for the jury's verdict and for their service here over 6 weeks of trial with more than 60 witnesses and thousands of pages of evidence. But this is only the start of the judicial reckoning for Chiquita. I would also say that— Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Marco. I wanted to ask you if you could talk about the original or the prior 2007 Chiquita Brand guilty plea to criminal charges that basically paved the way for this case.
Yeah, so in 2007, Chiquita pled guilty to a federal felony for essentially making financial transactions with a terrorist organization, which was the AUC paramilitaries, which was prohibited under U.S. federal law. And so they paid a $25 million fine at that point, but none of that money went to the victims of their conduct. Later that year, we filed suit. And for the past 17 years, we have been trying to get justice together with— you know, half a dozen different law firms who have who are also representing clients against Chiquita, and so this is the first step toward actually seeing that justice come to fruition. The federal prosecution of Chiquita was an important step in this process, but it's not necessarily the basis for these claims. The basis for the claims is Chiquita's conduct over more than 7 years during the Colombian armed conflict. So it is an important part of the picture. Chiquita is, essentially a convicted felon, and they did admit in the guilty plea, they admitted the essential elements of their conduct that has led to their liability here. But there's been a lot of litigation that's happened in the 17 years since then that has brought us to this point.
And could you talk about the history of Chiquita? Obviously, the former United Fruit Company, perhaps the first major American multinational in Latin America, but has an infamous history of scandal and intrigue throughout the region.
Yeah. So, I'm sure we don't have time to go into the complete history of the United Fruit Company in Latin America, but suffice to say that they are probably the company that, for the better part of the 20th century, was most associated with American imperialism in Latin America. And in fact, one of Chiquita's own documents, when they were considering buying farms in Colombia back in the late 1980s, one of their own documents says that every Colombian school child was essentially taught that Chiquita was associated with Yankee imperialism and is the prime example of that in Colombia. And so one of the things that I think is remarkable here is that, these Colombian families, most of them, essentially, living at the margins of economic life in Colombia, these are farm workers from rural Colombia, through the American justice system, they were able to essentially stand on equal footing with this major multinational corporation, which has been one of the most influential companies in Latin America for many, many decades, and prevail over them in this court process. There are also judicial processes ongoing in Colombia. There is a many years long transitional justice process and reckoning of the role of corporations and other actors in fueling the armed conflict in Colombia. But, one of the things that the American justice system, when it works, is particularly good at is in holding corporations accountable for their contributions to extreme injuries. And we believe this is the first time that an American jury has held a corporation responsible for its contribution to serious human rights abuses outside the United States. And so it's a significant step in that regard. It's not the first time that corporations have have paid remedies in such lawsuits. It's just that most corporations have chosen to settle these suits before going to trial. And I think this jury verdict shows that those corporations are wise to do so, because the jury thoroughly rejected, you know, Chiquita's defenses in this case.
I feel like I'm talking to two experts here. Marco Simons, who's with Earthrights, deeply involved with this case that was just brought in Florida. And Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now!, author of Harvest of Empire, a history of Latinos in America, you know, talking about this history. Chiquita's predecessor, United Fruit, responsible for the overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz and the democratically elected president of Guatemala in 1954. And then, you know, it becomes Chiquita. And this is a bipartisan affair in the United States. And I want to go back in time. In November 2008, we interviewed the Colombian-American journalist Mario Murillo and discussed Eric Holder's relationship as Chiquita's defense lawyer. At the time, Holder was being talked about, of course, he ultimately would be, President Barack Obama's pick for attorney general. This is Mario.
Holder, who is currently defending Chiquita Brand International in its defense against dozens of plaintiffs here in Colombia, working families who are targeted by paramilitaries who are funded to the tune of $1.7 million over the last several years. It's a major scandal, and if this guy becomes the attorney general under an Obama administration, then it's going to be really hard to find justice in this case coming from the United States.
And I'm looking at an article in The Guardian from 2008. The headline was Obama's Banana Problem. Marco Simons, if you can talk about this defense of Chiquita that went way back and the calculation they made if occasionally they had to pay millions of dollars, that was a price they would pay for continuing their work in Central America, the money they made much greater. But then if you can talk about the price that, for example, the people of Colombia paid.
Sure. But first, let me say, it's correct that Eric Holder originally led Chiquita's defense in this case, as well as their negotiations with the Department of Justice over their guilty plea. However, we don't have any reason to believe that that affected the course of the litigation once he became attorney general. You know, it's interesting to pair this story with the one about Hunter Biden, because I think both of them show that when the justice system in the United States works, it can work impartially. You know, this case, I think the what this case essentially shows is that the jury verdict here is a signal to corporate America that it can't treat the lives of people in the countries where they work as the cost of doing business in those countries. And that's what Chiquita did here. They essentially treated their payments, which fueled the armed conflict in Colombia, as simply the cost of doing business, similar to any other cost that they were trying to manage in producing bananas at the lowest price possible. And that led to, you know, the deaths of thousands of people, including the plaintiffs here. And unfortunately, the money that's been ordered in this case will never bring back those lives. We're still talking about horrific abuses here, and there's nothing that can be done to fix that ultimately. But the money is important because that's the language that corporations speak. And so if they are making calculations of the cost of doing business, they need to factor in the cost of being held liable for their actions. And if Chiquita did treat this as the cost of doing business, they did not evaluate those costs very well, because now they're facing potential exposure in the billions of dollars for their choices in Colombia. And so we hope that if anything good comes out of this, it is that other corporations, as well as Chiquita itself in the future, will not make the same choices to treat the lives of the people in the countries where they operate as the cost of doing business.
And, Marco, I'm wondering, for those of our viewers and listeners who are not familiar with the recent history of Colombia, if you could talk about who were the United Self-Defense Forces that Chiquita was paying for, and also why they were not prosecuted in Colombia itself. There are ties to several presidential, several presidents of Colombia in subsequent years.
Yeah, so the United Self-Defense Forces, known as the AUC, were a brutal paramilitary group that operated between about 1997 and 2006 in Colombia. So if you have any conception of death squads in Colombia, these are the folks you're thinking about. Now, Colombia has been in a protracted civil conflict for many decades involving left-wing guerrilla groups that have been seeking to overthrow the Colombian government, most of which have now demobilized and turned in their weapons. However, during the bloodiest period of this civil conflict, the AUC paramilitary group rose up to fight against the guerrillas using essentially tactics that were even more brutal than the guerrillas. And Chiquita knew this. They don't deny that they knew this. They, in fact, fully embrace this because they say that's why they were so scared of the AUC that they had to make these payments. So they fully knew of the AUC's brutality, its responsibility for massacres, the horrific, you know, ways in which it would murder people. And it was not limited to targeting guerrillas. The AUC targeted essentially anyone that it viewed as sympathetic to the left wing, whether those were trade unionists, politicians, anyone they viewed as sympathetic to the guerrillas. And in fact, anybody who disrupted the social order, the AUC was well known for its social cleansing operations as well. And some of the victims in these cases were also simply killed due to mistaken identity or due to conflicts with people in the AUC who essentially operated with impunity for years in the Colombian countryside. So this was the worst period of the Colombian civil conflict when the AUC decided that it needed to fight against the guerrillas, essentially protect the corporate and landowning interests in Colombia by using tactics that were even more brutal than the guerrillas' tactics. And the AUC got its start in some parts of the country, especially the banana-growing region, through the financing of banana growers and cattle ranchers. So this was an organization that was essentially created in order to defend those agricultural interests. And while Chiquita claims that it itself was threatened by the AUC, they also admitted that essentially none of these payments were the result of threats by the AUC, and that they were not aware of any cases where the AUC targeted American companies for violence. That was not the people that the AUC were targeting. Hmm.
During the trial, Marco Simons, you were lead counsel and presented a handwritten memo from 2000 written by Chiquita's in-house counsel, Robert Thomas. The memo lays out how the AUC set up legal fronts to receive payments and argues the payments are necessary because the company, quote, can't get the same level of support from the military. The memo, part of the National Security Archive's Chiquita papers, and was obtained through FOIA requests. We only have 30 seconds, but the significance of this and why John Doe, the victims, aren't named and how they'll get the money.
Sure. So just to clarify, I wasn't lead counsel. This was a team effort, and our lead presentation was by Florida trial attorney Jack Scarola. But this was— You know, look, the evidence in this case was very clear that Chiquita was making these payments voluntarily because they believed they were getting protection from the AUC against the guerrillas, and they just didn't care about the human cost of the protection money that they were paying.
Well, we're going to leave it there, and I thank you so much for being with us. Marco Simons, General Counsel for Earth Rights International, the nonprofit part of the legal team that represented the plaintiffs in the historic case against Chiquita. That does it for our show. To see our past coverage over decades of Chiquita, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusto Shrifton-Kadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
What is very relevant to what happens on the 7th of October is the last group of people who were pushed into the new refugee camp that Israel created in 1948 called the Gaza Strip. And I have found in the Israeli archive an order called Order Number 40 from the 25th of November 1948. And the order says very clearly, like so many other orders during the Nakba, occupy the villages, burn the houses, and expel the people to Gaza. So this is the main, I think, historical context we should tell people about.
That's Ilan Pape, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Ilan Pape on Gaza in context. Gaza's 2 million-plus Palestinians are jam-packed in a small, narrow enclave bordered by the Mediterranean Sea, Egypt, and Israel. Since 2007, it has been ruled by Hamas. Hamas is an Arabic acronym for Islamic Resistance Movement. Israel immediately imposed the blockade. Since then, Gaza has routinely been called the world's largest open-air prison. Its air, land, and sea were controlled by Israel. On October 7th, Hamas attacked Israel, resulting in over 1,100 Israeli dead and the taking of several hundred hostages. Israel, with one of the world's most advanced militaries, responded. Today, Gaza is in ruins. Palestinians have been killed and wounded in the tens of thousands. It has become, the UN says, a graveyard. How did this catastrophic situation develop? How did Gaza become Gaza? Our guest today is Ilan Pape. He's been called Israel's bravest historian. He taught at the University of Haifa and was chair of the Tuma Institute for Palestinian and Israeli Studies in Haifa. Today, he's professor of history at the University of Exeter in England. He's the author of many books, including 10 Myths About Israel. He spoke at the Bint Jebel Cultural Center in Dearborn, Michigan in mid-May 2024. And now, Ilan Pape.
When the Secretary General of the United Nations reacted to the events of the 7th of October by saying that we should remember that there is an historical context for what happens on the 7th of October, whether you condemn everything that was done or partly was done, or you don't condemn, it doesn't matter, he said. You have to understand that this attack by the Hamas was not done out of context. Or as he put it, it was not done in a vacuum. And immediately he was condemned as being an anti-Semite by the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, and the government of Israel demanded that he would be dismissed as a Secretary General of the United Nations. And then followed an incredible reaction by university management in some places in Europe, some places in the United States as well, almost forbidding people